speaker tonight is Maura. She's from Milford, Monday night, 12-164 meeting. And it's my pleasure to introduce Maura.
Thank you, Paul. And so hi, I'm Maura. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to get a couple things out of the way real quick. These are my healthcare shoes that I have on. I don't usually wear them to speaker meetings. So in case you think that, I thought that was a fashion statement. I left my boots on my kitchen table this morning, so that's not a really good place for them. But I'm recovered from the hopeless state of body and mind known as alcoholism, but that doesn't mean that my brain has recovered from the devastating effects of alcoholism, really, and drug addiction. So it took me a while to embrace that last statement, because I really would like to be somebody a little bit different than who I really am. But the 12 steps and you guys have reminded me over and over again that I am perfect and complete and welcome and loved and challenged. And those things are not something that I used to tell myself. So, and I actually didn't always hear them that much from the people in my life. So it's been a real joy to begin to step into that side of myself. But I have, so shoes, that's that. And then I have to say I felt really intimidated coming and speaking here. There's like CDs out there, and it's intimidating. Who wants to, not especially to talk as me, I never say the same thing ever, twice. I'm afraid, you know, what I might say tonight. So it would be really nice if you guys didn't record these things. But I don't think I have much to say over that, so that's that. And the third thing is, I didn't see when the announcement was made about newcomers in the meeting, and I didn't see any hands. And I would ask again for me, because I need newcomers if I want to stay sober. And I'm telling you, I really, really, really want to stay sober. It's an amazing way of life, and I don't want to go back out there to where I was 7 years and maybe 2 days ago. So, are there any newcomers in here?
More.
Welcome. I see some there. Welcome. Welcome. And I want to thank you so much for raising your hand, and I want to thank you so much for being here. All of you, and I and all the rest of you guys, I certainly couldn't stay sober without you guys. I wouldn't have a prayer. I tried it. I tried it and very unsuccessfully. And I really didn't want to have a room full of people helping me. That was the last thing I wanted in my life, was a room full of people, and certainly people that I didn't know, helping me. It was not something that I was comfortable with at all. So I've learned, I've changed as a result of taking these steps. I have, through grace, I have learned to let go some of what I call the dragon scales, and allow myself to be helped. And I was always in a helping role, and it's been really hard for me to move into the being helped role. And I had to be in that role for a long time when I first got sober. And I didn't have a car, and I had to rely on a lot of people. And that was the biggest gift I ever got, was having to consistently ask for help. It was without a doubt, the ability to allow somebody else the gift of helping is God's grace. And to allow myself to be vulnerable enough to be helped. So I'm going to read a poem that I came across, and I hope you like it. And holy crap, the poem moved on me, because it is not by Huffies. Okay, it's by Mark Nepo. And here it is. This is a poem by Mark Nepo, and it starts off by saying, "Having loved enough and lost enough, I'm no longer searching, just opening, no longer trying to make sense of pain, but trying to be a soft and sturdy home in which real things can land. These are the irritations that rub into a pearl. So we can talk for a while, but then we must listen, the way rocks listen to the sea. And we can churn at all that goes wrong, but then we must lay all distractions down and water every living seed. And yes, on nights like tonight, I too feel alone. But seldom do I face it squarely enough to see that it's a door into the endless breath that has no breather, into the surf that human shells call God." And that really spoke to me, because I came in here and I had loved and lost, and I was really angry. So I feel like taking the 12 steps and practicing them as part of my life has emptied me out and allowed space for me to realize that I am part of this living ocean. I am part of that ocean, otherwise known as God. I'm not separate from you guys, no matter what my mind tells me, no matter what my disease of alcoholism tells me. So this is like the absolute perfect program for me. And I think for every human being on this planet, it's the absolute perfect program. So 7 years ago, to enter days, I was lying in my bed with a black coat covered with cat hair, and I was all alone, and I had, for the many time in my life, thought, I could just get up again one more time, you know, and I could just somehow pull it together, but there was this small voice inside of me that said, like, you know, no, let somebody else help you. And that's, you know, I started out with that statement, but I had been drinking, you know, for many, many, many years. I used to pride myself that I wouldn't be a 24-hour drinker, you know, and that I could control it and all this stuff back in my 20s. And then if I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about how much I wasn't drinking. And I was thinking that if I could only not drink for a certain amount of time, that I could really drink again. And that certain amount of time was usually about 2 days. Certainly I had the physical allergy to alcoholism. Once I put a drink in my body, I could not safely predict when I would stop. I always thought I could control it. I remember back when I was 18 or 19, I used to go to work at this restaurant bar, and always stopping before work to get a drink. We were allowed to drink at work, but I always had to get a drink before work. And I would always think, like, that whole thing of, you know, I'm definitely just going to have that one, you know. And I was always late, and I was always getting, I got written up in a restaurant. Nobody gets written up in restaurants. You know, we actually worked at a restaurant that was unionized. There was only five of us, you know. It was practically five. That's a little bit of a guy, but it was probably ten. And we were a bunch of political junkies in Rutgers University that thought we were going to change the world. And, you know, talked about how to, you know, workers' rights and healthcare, you know. Well, we gugged down scotch and, you know, snorted lines of cocaine and, you know, were terribly irresponsible. So I had, that was, you know, the allergy was there right from the start. And I'll tell you, I had no idea that it was a disease back then. I certainly did not think, I just thought that basically all of us were just a bunch of irresponsible people. And the people I worked with at that time, now that I think of it, you know, one of us got sober. One person got sober. The rest have really all just, there's a sad lot of people that, or most of them died. So, anyway, and I had the mental obsession that always told me day after day that it would be different. And that was back when I was 18 and 19. I got sober when I was 44. And I definitely had the spiritual malady. Of thinking that I had to wrestle satisfaction out of life, and I had to wrestle satisfaction out of you guys, and I definitely did not feel connected to the world around me. In fact, I thought you guys were my competition. So, and I really thought that I had to protect myself against you guys. I had to protect myself against any levels of intimacy, because I had, you know, like many of us that come in here, I had a very poor history by the time of like 12 of intimacy gone wrong. So it was very hard for me to trust myself or trust others. I engaged in a lot of behavior from young on that I had a lot of shame and guilt around. And certainly wasn't anything that was going to be discussed in my family. I don't think to this day there's anything that's going to be really discussed in my family, except, you know, I don't know, what are we having for dinner? I have an amazing family. I mean, I love them dearly, and I would say that's probably an incorrect statement. Because my mother is changing, and the people in my family are changing too, so that's not fair. But, so I have a spiritual malady. I tried to get sober, I don't know about it. I tried to stop once in a while. Mostly to get the heat off. I would do, you know, like we all do. I would say that I know I can do better than this, you know, and I'd move or do something like that or change people, the whole deal. But I would always just continue to do the same old thing. At one point in the early 90s, when I would, I'll just say that I lived in New York for many years and it was really bad. It's like how New York gets. It gets crackheady and all that, and I was on many, many different clinics in New York, I became very demoralized. I did try to stop back then, but never through a 12-step program. I tried going away. Back then, doctors would, you know, give you medications, and I tried a number of times to go far away and detox off of the multiple substances that I was on, and I would always end up back within 24 hours, you know, or 48 hours. It was awful. And then demoralized again, back at work again. It was just a big mess. And I, somewhere in the 90s, when it was quite bad, my mom Walter came and got me, brought me to New Jersey, and for 24 hours on Christmas, I stayed home, and then I went back to the city, and then I came back again, against my will, and I went to the 12-step program, and I thought, you guys were interesting, and I thought that some of you guys were losers. I was about 80 pounds, and I was a crack addict on methadone, and hadn't been able to keep a job in many years, but you guys were losers. So I had the delusion of grandeur for sure. But at that time, I absolutely did not believe it, that this was a disease. And I had that whole idea that I was very much supported by my family. You've been able to do just anything you put your mind to, so just do it. And that got me back doing the exact same thing within a couple of weeks. I just had a very funny memory of the demise there. The first thing, I don't think I can say this, it's on tape. I can't say it, never mind.
We don't have to tape it.
Yeah.
Okay.
We can take it off.
Well, this is just a lighthearted anecdote, and then I really will get into the meat of what keeps me sober. So I decided, I got cleaned up, I got an apartment, I got a job, within like a month or so of leaving New York. And I thought, okay, now I feel better. The first thing I thought, I know this is an Alcoholics Anonymous, but alcohol really kicked my ass, I'm telling you. And I hated, I loved to drink when it used to be the solution. I loved drinking. But I got so drunk and blacked out so much that it was so uncomfortable for me to drink. I threw up. I had a terrible reaction. So until I found other drugs, I was just always violently ill. And other drugs also made me violently ill. So I was a projectile vomiter for many years. But anyway, this is the last minute of levity, but I went, I decided in Spring Lake Heights, where I was living, to go to Asbury Park, because I thought there would be drugs, and I was going to go to my home crack. So I go to some gentlemen on the street that look like they might know where crack was, and I ask them if they could get me some. So the one guy says, yeah, I think there's a guy that I know that can help you out. That. So he introduces me to those guys. The guy gets in my car. We drive to go find crack. And we pull over. It's like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. We pull over in front of a seafood restaurant. And he goes, oh, it's closed. And I said, I don't understand why I'm here. Why are we here? And he said, well, you wanted to get crabs, right? I said, no, crack. And he goes, oh. I do know where to get back. So that was the beginning of the end for the next 12 years. I started drinking again. And I started drinking with a vengeance because the other substances weren't working anymore. We had this brilliant idea. I lived with an addict and an alcoholic that maybe we would stop doing the majority of the other substances, the majority, and we would buy a little bottle of vodka. We were going to go to Europe. So we're going to save money. And so we bought a little bottle of vodka, and I remember standing in my kitchen knowing, this is just not a good idea. And I was always afraid. I drank in bars. I drank beer a lot and scotch, but I was afraid to get bottles because I knew that it would be the end. So anyway, by the end of that night, we had gone out and got many more bottles, and then for the next 12 years, I drank 24 hours a day. Vodka, always with a vodka in my hand and in my drink, at work, working with children, driving up and down the Garden State Parkway. I had children in my life. I got in many accidents. I was pulled over many times, and I could not stop. at all. And quite frankly, I didn't want to stop at that point because I was, I don't know, I didn't think I was worth it, and I didn't think there was any other hope for me, and that's that. So fast forward 12 years later, my brother came and said, I remember you. I remember my sister when she was a real person, and she used to make me grilled cheese sandwiches, and she used to sing and dance, and I haven't seen that person in 20 or 30 years. So that was the first moment that I had a glimpse of a memory of what life was like before drugs and alcohol. Prior to that, like, I really hadn't, I didn't even recall. It wasn't even part of who I was. And the other thing that my brother said to me was, I don't have a plan, and I don't know what to do, and all I want to do is help. And up until that point, everybody else had said, you need to stop, you need to stop, you need to stop, get your act together, da da da. And he had this really, to me, it was that spoke to something inside of me that was, I think it was just love. I really do. I just think it was God's love that said, you're going to be okay. It's somewhere in that. So I think about that a lot when I'm working with other alcoholics and I live with other, I had my partner at the time that I lived with, didn't get sober for a long time, and I still would use those words then. So I think that really informs me in my 12-step work as well. So I went to treatment, blah, blah, blah. Fast forward. I was introduced to the 12 steps, and I was in detox, I was in rehab, I was in the psychiatric unit. A lot of people brought meetings in, from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was not very excited about the whole thing. Again, interesting story, very good, thank you. I've been there, I've done that, and I don't think, like, for me, and I think a lot of people here, my life depended on this program working. When I came in, and I skipped a lot of the details, but I really was an incredible mess, and I was really wanted, if I had any bravery, I was committed to suicide, and I think you guys all know that feeling. I totally wanted to die, and I totally could not get up the nerve to do that. I totally wanted somebody to help me, and I didn't really know how to ask somebody to help me. So I ranted and raved and screamed and threw things and was beside myself. And I really felt like I needed to find God. And I had no idea of how to do that. And I had gone before I got sober to various things, you know, that when we try to, like, find God and we don't really know how to do that. And I went to a memorial service for someone who died sober from, you know, like, the things that happen to our liver when we use too many drugs. And she had found God, and I kept thinking if I just went to her church, I would find God, too. They actually kept asking me to leave. They were very nice, but I kept coming in really high and messed up. And, so I wanted to be on, like, their committees, and I wanted to tutor the kids. And they were very nice, but they just wouldn't let me do that. And they told me I should find a counselor to help me with my drug and alcohol problem. I'm like, no, I just want to tutor kids and find God. I was in these various treatment things, and then I went into rehab, and that was where a group of women came in, And up until then, I really just wanted to get out of like that whole system. I wanted to take over. I wanted to find God. I thought I had to go to a monastery. And I was really, I had this fantasy of that. Like, I kept thinking about if they would just let me go and sit in a little room and, you know, hurt and like in a world thing, I could maybe figure it out. But these women came in and they started talking about the solution that you got to talk about, that's real for real. It wasn't, you know, go to AA and all your problems will be cured. And, you know, that just to me, honestly, was a bunch of bullshit. Because I had gone to AA and I listened and none of my problems were cured. And it was your fault. It wasn't my fault. So they started talking about, there were some women that had, they had been sober for a number of years in AA. And they said they got sicker. And, then there were some other women that said they had got sober, they were okay, but they felt really restless and irritable, and they weren't sicker, but something was wrong. And they met this other woman, Iris, who took them through the steps, as they're laid out in the big book, and they had spiritual awakenings as a result, and they were there to share that message. And I'll never forget sitting there in Keyport, and like that way the room to me felt like it was it lit up with a glow. And so the woman's name was Iris, she was from Cold Snack, and I had a mission. I wanted to find this woman when I got out, but I ended up going to a variety of halfway houses and got kicked out of one, and I finally got to a second one. And in the meantime, though, I'll have to say, like, this is, I don't know, maybe it's not politically correct or something, but I went to some AA meetings out in Cunningham County, which I eventually got sober in, and they were really bad meetings, I'll tell you that. They were just not good AA meetings. They didn't carry a message of the spiritual solution, and I thought, so I actually didn't go to that halfway house. I went to another one, or kicked out of there. So be really careful. I mean, I don't think if I was in the dire, I was homeless and indigent at the time, and I had to go into a place. And I don't know that I would have gotten sober if it wasn't for being in captivity to some extent. And then, you know, really hearing again, finding a sponsor that would take me through the steps as they're laid out. So I went to a meeting. It was a big book meeting after I got to the second halfway house. People were talking about, we read about like step 11 out of the big book, but everybody started sharing about, I don't know, I can remember, a guy's mother was in a nursing home and he didn't like the way the staff was treating her, and the other woman had cancer and she was angry about that, and I got really pissed. And I raised my hand and I said, I need to find God now. And I haven't heard anybody talking about that. And I need help. And I was told to come out here and that you guys would help me. And after the meeting, a woman came up to me and said that she would help. And she said, you have to do a couple of things, though, sweetheart. She taught me about willingness and open-mindedness. And humility. She said that those are the three keys to staying sober. And I actually did those like that. Like, I really thought at that moment when she said those things that I was going to be okay. And it was the most important moment in my life, in my sobriety, because I really felt like I could begin. And somebody heard what I was saying, and somebody was willing to help me in this process. So we got together, we went up on a mountain, and I thought, you know, not that anybody has to go up on a mountain, but we went up on Point Mountain, and she qualified herself as an alcoholic, like I just did, and she asked me if I could admit to myself that I was an alcoholic, and I said absolutely without a doubt, and she said that's the first step. You don't have to worry about powerless and unmanageability and all that. That's just a description of your life. It's not important, and you don't have to even think about it after that. You just have to know what the problem is. If you know what the problem is, the solution will work for you. I absolutely know what the problem is. And I actually know that I'm the problem. By that point, I really knew that I was the problem because I hadn't had a drink or a drug in 4 or 5 months. And as excited as I was about that, I was talking to somebody new, like you're relatively sober. I was unbelievably beyond belief that I hadn't taken any substance into my body. That was a miracle. That had never happened in my life. I could not believe that. But inside, I kind of felt worse than I ever felt in my life. And I knew that without the drugs and the alcohol were not the problem. There was something that needed to be fixed internally in me, not fixed from a psychological perspective, but fixed from a spiritual perspective. And so she said, you know the problem, and she asked me if I believed in a higher power. And I said, I have an idea about God, but I don't know that I believe in God. I'm here to find God, and I don't even know anything. I don't even know. It's like crazy what the idea is about God. So she said, well, you just have to be willing to be open-minded. And that was the second step. And I was willing to change my mind. I was willing to be open-minded. And then we said the third step prayer. And that's simply it. We said together, she said, are you really ready to go on? You know what the 12 steps are. You came here already known because I wrote the big book. And I told her that because it says here, if your person is willing to go through with this plan of action, if they write this book, you know, they're willing to sit down and have a chat. So I read that. And I said it to her, like, I'm willing to sit down and have that chat. But, you know, that fourth step, and I want to know what I need to do with men, and I want to know how to take an inventory and all that stuff. And she, we said the third step prayer. And it was really, really sincere. So once you sincerely said this prayer, you're on your way. And for the newcomers, the third step prayer is just a prayer that we offer ourselves. We make a decision to let a higher power and spiritual principles guide our recovery. It's simply that. And once we make that decision, we need to know what it is that are blocking us from having a relationship with God and those around us. And my sponsor has a list of the 7 defects of character: resentment, fear, dishonesty, self-centeredness, jealousy, envy, pride, and laziness. That's what Dr. Bob added to said. So I know a lot about laziness. And so we sat up on a rock in Point Mountain, and she had me tell her about why I was resentful and who, and she heard me talk about the things that I no longer wanted to carry in my life. By that point, I really no longer wanted to. There had been some things that had gone on in my life that I wanted to let go of. And it took, for me, a lot of trust to just tell somebody about those things. And she asked me about my fears. I told her about my fears. I'm afraid, like I was tonight, I'm afraid of being embarrassed. I'm afraid to death of being alone. That's probably my biggest fear. I'm afraid of dying in a nursing home alone. I'm afraid of pain, physical and emotional. I'm afraid of embarrassment, and I'm afraid of rejection, and I'm afraid of humiliation, and I was afraid of her. So, I told her that. I really wanted to get sober more than anything, and I was really going to put myself out on one end, and she said, well, how about you let somebody else take care of those things instead of you? And that's what you're going to allow your higher power. When those things come up, you're going to turn to a higher power, and you're going to open to them, you're going to let them in, you're going to sit with them, you're not going to abandon yourself anymore when those things come up. And so I still do that today. And we talked about resentment and pride, feeling better and less than people, etc. And we looked at the relationships that were current in my life and how those character defects created problems in those relationships. At the time, glaringly, I was responded by stolen. I had, you know, caused harm from my resentment. So she said, there's resentment, did you cause a harm? There's a fear, did you cause a harm? Dishonesty, did you cause a harm? It was pretty straightforward, man. I was a thief and a liar, and I had a really bad mouth at the time. So I'm still getting a little bit better. But the for me, a lot of that came from my fears, and when I realized that, we got the list of amends. It was a few that needed to be taken care of right away. I went to the people and I said, these are the things that I've done that have caused you harm, and I'm really sorry that I've caused you these harms, and that's not the person that I want to be anymore. And I need you to help me understand you so that I can get better. And that was where the line that my father told me. I did that. And it was the beginning of being able to tolerate discomfort. Going to the people in my life that I had really, really harmed and sit through and ask them, is there anything more? Is there anything else you'd like me to hear? And that was the most liberating experience I've ever had in my life. For once in my life, I didn't take a nap. And I think because my mom used to always tell me things that she didn't like, and I used to get like, that thing, I'm just going to stop soon. She's going to give me the $20 and I'll get the hell out of here, But that is like my whole life. Totally disassociating from what was being said, as long as I knew there was a pay at the end. So I learned not to do that anymore, and I learned the grace that came kind of along with that, and I actually began to have meaningful relationships with people, surprise, surprise. And I began to really feel like I was walking in the sunlight of the spirit, and I began to feel like I was a human being. I was no longer like this fearful, isolated self. So we at that sitting at Point Mountain, we took the fourth and fifth step. We identified the character defect. I asked God, that I didn't have any understanding of it all, to remove them and to help me. And that's still something that I say every day. Same prayer, same seven-step prayer. My Creator, I know that you have all of me, good and bad. And both the third step and the seven-step prayer are specifically to remove the things that block us in our effectiveness to others and in our ability to serve God. To me, that sounds like so crazy, or serve God. But over the years, when I first came in here, I thought, that's a big order. But for me, that principle is every action and every word that I take. Is it bringing me a sense of peace? And is it an honest word? Am I considering others in the actions that I take? Am I looking to minimize my suffering and the suffering of others? And that's serving God. To me, that is my feeling. And sometimes I don't want to do that. We all know that, And then we got to sit with that, too. I was on a four-day retreat recently, and I had to sit with the fact that I didn't want to have good intentions towards a certain person. And that's really uncomfortable, right? The more we get sober and we have to sit with the truth of who we are as human beings and open to that over and over again in silence. Now you're not really my person. And what I found over and over again is if I stay with that, I become, again, part of the ocean, otherwise known as God. I'm no longer, holding on to the thought of a creek, me and my army. I'm really just part of the sea, and I'm not afraid of being sometimes a little bit ornery. So, most importantly, though, my sponsor, the day that she said about open-mindedness, willingness, and humility, she also asked me, she said, I will take you through these 12 steps if you will take other women through these 12 steps. And she looked at me right in the eyes and she said, can you make that promise? And I said, absolutely. I have no idea if I'll do that. I did say it, and I have continued to keep that promise, thank God, because it saved my life. And I didn't realize how taking other women through the steps would save my life. And so she said, you've looked at these defects of character now every day. These are the things that you'll look at every day. When they pop up, you'll pause. You'll discuss them with another person. You'll ask God to remove them, and you'll turn your thoughts resolutely to someone you may help. And if you use that exact same pattern, for 7 years straight, it's no more complicated than that. And the steps are not as psychological. They're not supposed to have some cathartic event. They're a set of spiritual principles. They're not psychological principles. They're simply when we are in self-will, 7 simple characteristics, we are in bondage to self. And when we recognize them, we simply move into the opposite. Forgiveness and faith and contentment. And it's simply that simple. It says in, and I still do this, Laura and I were having dinner together, and I still wake up, I follow the directions in the book. And it says, upon awakening, we ask God, we consider the 24 hours ahead, we ask God to direct our thinking, whether it be divorce of self-seeking and self, any self-seeking motives. I bring that intention strongly into our morning. I consider who I'm going to come across during the day. And we bring the vision of God's will into our life. And often, for me, it's very simple. It's making breakfast for my partner. It's taking out the garbage and not saying, garbage. It's simply, will this help another person if I do this? And I do have a prayer and meditation practice. It's very deeply, as it says in the 12 and 12, which is not my Bible, but the big book is. But it does say self-examination when coupled with prayer and meditation is a recipe for a life filled with liberation and freedom from alcoholism. So I do, it also says to listen carefully to people of religious faith and to listen to them and hear what they have to say. And I can't think somebody could help me make right of what's it? See where religious people are right. And I think that's a really important statement because I spend a lot of time seeing where people were wrong. And so I think that it has been very liberating and freeing for me. Since I got sober, much of my life has been, the spiritual quest that we get on as good alcoholics, trying to find out everything that I did in the beginning. I tried to find out everything I can. I went to different churches and mosques and monasteries and I tried to see where religious people were right. And I could see where some of them were wrong. There's there's a fundamentalism that's troublesome in this world, for sure. But I can see where people are right, and I can see where there's a great, there is liberation in particular attitudes that are common to every faith and to every spiritual life. And they are liberating no matter what spiritual faith you follow. And they are forgiveness and love and courage and contentment and humility and action. So that's the our 12th step, right? So everyone that's here, certainly do not miss meditation and prayer. And it's an essential part of my program. And the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Right? So we get one day, boom, I was a self-centered person who really only cared that if I didn't go to work, I was afraid that I would get fired. If you found out that you stole from me, I was afraid you wouldn't like me. Or that I stole from you, you wouldn't like me. And after taking a look at that behavior, I began to have the entire complete psychic change. It did not become a thing, but all of a sudden I realized if I didn't go to work, my colleagues would suffer. If I took your money, you wouldn't have enough to eat. It was always about me prior to that, and I have been given the gift of considering others and all the actions that I take. I eat healthy because I want to be there for you guys. And I want to be there for myself. It's not because of anything else. It simply works. So I go to meetings in AA with the sole purpose of finding a newcomer to let them know that there is a very clear direction and there's a very clear solution. It's not complicated. There's no reason to complicate it. We simply make a decision. Sit down with somebody and have a conversation. Identify clearly your defects of character and begin to ask God for help with them every day. And go out and find somebody else and say, this is what we do. You have a disease that will kill you. And I know the solution and I'll help you. So as we stay here, we put another person's hand into the hand of God and we let God do the rest of the work. So it's not tiring. It's not exhausting. I don't fret and worry anymore because I've got a really good solution. And with that purpose, so the purpose of sobriety is to fit ourselves to be a service to God and the best. We have to take care of ourselves so that we can be there for others. And I can't imagine not being having that gift, because it used to be that if I went to AA and I didn't like what I heard, I could leave. And if I liked what I heard and I got what I wanted, I could leave. And we all know what happens. So I've heard enough stories from this podium about what happens when we do that. So. I know that my purpose is to be here, stay sober, by carrying messages and helping somebody else stay sober by passing on that message to them. And that's what I do, and it's worked so far. So thank you all so much.